Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Tribe of Two, the officially unofficial podcast for The Mandalorian on Disney+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 3, Episode 4, Chapter 20, The Foundling. Aaron, this is a really short episode. I think all told, action of the episode is like 30 minutes. And then you got credits. It's under 30? It might be under 30 with credits and like preview previously on.
Yes.
Did you think anything of it?
Yeah, okay. Yes, I agree it was short. Did it feel short to you though? Because I didn't. I thought this episode hit the spot for me.
Oh, okay.
I really enjoyed it. I really noticed how cute Grogu is.
Just now noticing, you know. Huh? Just
no,
now.
I mean, I have catch before, up. But like I feel like, yeah, well, we went away from him almost entirely the last episode. And I was thinking, like, you know, usually the show hits you over the head a lot of times. And in these four episodes, I can think of, like, well, him crawling through the little bubble tunnel to crawl up in Mando's lap. That was really cute. But, like, this episode really showcases him and showcases his the fact that he's a practical effect, you know, which I think adds immensely to his charm and his likability that he kind of, like, they did a little stop motion. They did, you know, a lot of old school puppetry, and I think that's really cool. I really continue to enjoy the exploration of the Mandalorian culture, and I appreciated the flashback we got of Order 66 Eve. And I got a lot more to say about that scene. I thought this is it's not a perfect episode. There's a few quibbles I have, mostly around how the fuck the biology of this parent feeding its children actually works.
They eat Beskar.
Yeah.
No,
yeah. You have to roll a Mandalorian youth around in your gullet for at least 24 hours before it's properly tenderized so you can spit it up to your children.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I thought it's great. What do you think?
Yeah, I liked it. There's nothing to really object to in this episode. It's kind of a short one. Half of it is action. And yeah, I found myself thinking at the beginning of this, boy, I wonder if this is going to be worth anything, because they start off with, you know, a training sequence that's like, okay, I guess Mando is continuing Grogu's training here. And that was interesting to me. And then we got off on this side quest, and I was like, oh boy, is this going to be the rest of the episode? But it wasn't. There was enough in there with flashbacks and with the armorer kind of talking to both Grogu and to Bo-Katan that I think it was warranted. You know, even though it's a short episode, they did quite a bit with it. So yeah, I ended up liking it.
Yeah, I really like what they're doing with Bo-Katan. I think they're rope-a-doping us. Like, I think they're going down the road of you thinking that she's really into the Mando culture. And I think it's going more for her seeing a way to simultaneously explore and exploit okay, the Mandalorian culture. But I don't know. It's honestly hard to tell. Boy, this is a human problem. Hard to tell the true believers from the grifters, you know?
Totally.
From the cynics. So, but I kind of feel like that's where they're going with her. And I think it's also fascinating that once you put the helmet on Katie Sackhoff, she's much more inscrutable. You know, like, you can't see whether she's smirking or frowning or whatever. All you just have this impassive face listening to Mando, listening to, you know, the rest of the tribe, listening to the armorer. And I think it does a good job of making her a lot more mysterious. So, like, these are all the speculations. I mean, I don't have anything to judge by other than you know, how she's emoting through the armor. So I think that's kind of been interesting too.
Yeah, I think they've done a good job of telling me kind of what she's thinking even through the armor. I the other thing about this whole scenario that kind of squicks me out a little bit is how do you tell the good cults from the bad cults? And if this wasn't the Mandalorians, if this were some other unknown cult, we might be a lot more skeptical about what's going on here, right?
Yeah. I don't think this is a good cult.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
At all. Yeah.
I mean, I find it hard to imagine any cult that's good because of the nature of cults. But like, yeah, I think there's a tendency here to go like, oh, she's returning to the old ways. That's great. I don't know if that's totally true. I don't know if it is great, but we'll see. We'll see. Should we get into the episode?
Yeah, I just want to point out one thing that doesn't go anywhere else. Did you know that this Carl Weathers directed this episode?
I saw that, yeah.
I think that's pretty cool. I wondered if this was kind of like, oh, he's starting off late in life, but he's been directing TV for over 20 years, and he's really worked his way. Like, I think his first directorial debut was for this old She-Ra live action. Do you remember when the Kevin Sorbo?
I don't remember She-Ra, no.
Well, I mean, but I was like, they had the mainline Hercules and Xena, and then they had some of the really, you know, I think they had a Conan that was on, like, you know, like that. We're talking about like what, UPN, like whatever off channel from that. You had She-Ra and I think they had a Jason Argonauts, but it's like, you know, people were just like, hey, there's money to be had in this pseudo Greek bullshit. Pseudo Greek god bullshit. But yeah, he started that, and he's just like kind of been working his way up and done, you know, I think he had 70 directorial credits to his name. So I think he did a great job.
Sure. Yeah, I like it.
It's probably got to be the highest budget, most action thing he's ever done. And there was a lot of high budget action that I thought was really cool. So good for you, Carl Weathers.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty high profile. So that's cool. All right, let's get into the recap. We start off with the Mando's training as Bo-Katan looks on. Grogu watches crabs on the beach, and then Din inserts him into the Mando training program here, and Grogu fights a kid, and he gets hit with two of the three darts that you need to win the match before using his force powers to score three hits at a time. This is apparently legal. You could apparently just fire all three darts.
I have in my notes what in the Quidditch is happening here, because I felt like they established that this is a system where, you know, like in any kind of martial arts where you go and engage, you score a point, the judge awards it, and then you reset and you do it again. Mm-hmm. And Grogu just like fucking gets to Golden Snitch and just blow, you know, hit him with like that kid surely could have done that at any point.
Yeah, I don't know if he's like playing with Grogu, you know, like, oh, this kid's gonna be so easy to beat, I might as well just, you know, shoot him one at a time, really humiliate him or what. But yeah, why didn't the other kid do that? Seems
But I mean, like, it could go to like Mando is saying, I did like that where the kid's like, this, he's too small, he doesn't this, although I want to say to this little shit, I just saw you get your fucking helmet two episodes ago, all right. And you can you can walk and talk and form complete sentences. How dare you ask where this baby's helmet is, you son of a bitch. anyway, yeah, I didn't like him talking down to Baby Yoda.
He made the classic Star Wars mistake of judging someone by their size.
Exactly.
Classic.
That's like, yeah, I love that, you know, Mando's, well, then perhaps this lesson's not for you. Or perhaps this lesson is meant for you, which would have been hilarious if the kid did just hit Yoda or Baby Yoda three times in the chest, because he could have been like, yeah, what do you think about that, Chrome Dome? I don't know, like I said, I really like how puppety he is. I liked him fucking with the hermit crabs. I really loved when Bo-Katan straps that dart launcher to his wrist, but it essentially covers his entire arm.
Sure.
This little wrist cuff.
They don't make Grogu sized wrist darts.
I bet the armor, I see. Where are you at with Grogu actually getting fitted full head to toe in Mandalorian armor?
Boy, we're far aside from that. I think it's going to be like we talked about, like, what does a Grogu helmet look like? Where do the ears go? All that stuff. Like, I think it's going to be kind of ridiculous if it ever happens. So I kind of expect it not to happen.
I saw some people, like Joe Robinson, our buddy over at The Ringer, was saying, stop putting the baby in armor after this episode, because it's obviously the more he gets armored up, the more danger he's going to be in. And, you know, there's a whole child soldier thing. But
sure. And the less cute he is, right? I mean,
I don't know.
It's those big eyes. You can't cover that face.
I think he's going to be. Well, first of all, I do think that they are going to. They're going to find a way to unhelmet the majority of the Mandalorians. I think they're going to. There's going to be a synthesis because, yeah, there's no fucking way you're going to cover Baby Yoda's entire head all the time. But, but him waddling around in full Mandalorian armor with like some kind of hat helmet that, you know, either covers his ears or I hope like exposes his ears or maybe even like works his ears in some kind of horn motif. Oh, I'm actually really looking forward to that. I think that's gonna be fucking cool.
I think he needs to get everything but the helmet, and then he like puts on Dad's helmet and waddles around because that'll be even funnier. Like him, his tiny body in a giant Mando helmet, that'd be great.
Maybe they just make his whole armor from it. Like they just drill a hole out the top and two holes out the sides, and like the entire helmet is his like breastplate.
Okay, just makeshift Mando armor. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love his little chainmail shirt this whole time. You can kind of see it peeking out from under his robes. I love that. It's a nice touch.
And I like Mando being a dad, like this whole like classy, don't look at me, look at him. Like that's been uttered in baseball diamonds and boxing rings and football fields and basketball courts by millions and millions of times all around the world. Soccer pitches. And I also like the don't speak unless one knows. I like getting all these kind of like Ferengi rules of acquisition, like little bits of the creed that, you know, and how you find out that this kid that got shined on by Grogu, his dad turns out that this Paz guy echoes it back to him. Like his dad's like, you know, as his son's walking off, you know, disappointed. He's like, you know, making sure the lesson sinks in. I thought, I don't know. It's... Uh-huh. It's a tough society, but it does seem like the parents love their kids, which is... And I guess these are all adoptive children?
I assume they're all foundlings, but I don't know.
I'm trying to think if they've... I thought there was something in the first season about the Mandalorian saying something about how romantic entanglements and stuff work in these clans. But I don't know. Maybe they reproduce solely by just getting foundlings, in which case... You know, I thought that was pretty moving that this guy is like so attached to his just like we understand Mando being attached to Grogu, right?
Yeah, it does really make me wonder why they don't have any variation in helmets if that's the case. Like they've never had a Twi'lek, or an Ithorian, or like even a Mon Calamarian, like. Somebody whose helmet won't fit if it's standard shaped. They've never had anyone like that if these are all foundlings?
Surely not, because like it seems like what they treat as foundlings, as we'll see in this episode, is pretty broad, you know? So like,
right.
You'd have to have some kind of way to accommodate that. But you're right, yeah.
We've never seen it.
Super humanoid, anyway, cult so far.
Mm-hmm. Do not remove your helmet. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
This is the way. Back to the podcast. Here's more Tribe of Two. All right, a dragon comes out of the sky, grabs the kid that Grogu was fighting and takes him away. Din and several other Mandos follow it, but they run out of fuel and have to land. And then Bo speeds past overhead in her ship following the dragon. And she returns and says, I know where the dragon is. And then they decide, yeah, we're going to take Bo, Mando, and what they're calling the Shriek Hawk training team, including Paz Vizsla, to go after the boy.
Yeah, and it's all makes a lot more sense, or it's interesting on subsequent rewatches. This, you know, they reveal Paz Vizsla to be this foundling's or just child's father, and like throughout the episode, he's the one like keeping Mandalorians from like firing at the, you know, insisting that we don't use blasters, showing extra concern for this child, and it makes sense on subsequent watches that like he is particularly. I mean, it seems like all the Mandalorians roll with most people, our highest creed is we should save children, you know. Everybody feels good about that one. But, like, in particular, this is his son. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it seems hard to believe that firing a blaster at a target that big would result in accidentally hitting the child, but...
That's a chance.
There's a chance, I suppose.
Especially if it's, like, it's swallowed, so, like, anything that you, like... You know, he's inside the monster, so where is a safe part to shoot him? Like, center mass? No. Head? Eh, what if he's long? I mean, I don't know. I mean,
he's not inside the monster until later, right?
Oh, I thought he just got up and got swallowed.
Did he? I thought he got taken away in the claws.
Picked up by the claws. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd shoot at it, but then I'd probably have to deal with Paz.
He's not your foundling.
That wouldn't be fun. I know.
You're failing the Solomon test here.
I'll just say it went off, man. I don't know what happened. My blaster just went off. Yeah, so did my flamethrower and my wrist rocket.
I wouldn't want to be on the other side of Paz Vizsla, man. This dude is fucking huge. He has got a foundation that you, like, his, like, everything, I mean, he's just in a unit, but, like, especially below the fucking belt, he is, like, fucking massive thick. Boba Fett is what this guy is. Not in the PHAT. He is caked up. He's got thighs like Mando's entire chest. It's like this guy looks like
thighs like what?
Looks like a Titan from Destiny down to the butt towel he's wearing. Which I can only assume is modesty, because like all the other Mandalorians couldn't stop staring. He's like, the armor is like, Paz, I must conceal your cake because it's distracting all the students. They're not paying attention to their studies. All they can do is look at it. We must drape it with cloth.
They tried to put him in standard Mandalorian butt plate armor, but it just wouldn't fit. Like, they only have one size, like helmets, and he's just got too much going on.
I don't have a spherical mold bubbly enough for your butt, Paz. You're going to have to make do with the butt towel.
Yeah. It's his one weakness. Anyway, while Mando's away, the armorer invites Grogu to begin working on becoming a Mandalorian. And she shows him the Forge and tells him of its importance to the Mandalorian culture. All about it, you know, revealing weaknesses. And then this is when Grogu flashes back. Do you want to go through all of this right now, or do you want to talk about the first part?
I thought all the armor talk was cool. It confused me at first because, like, there's this dawning horror on Grogu's face, and I'm like, what is going on? Like, why is he scared of her hammering all the shit he's seen? But, like, it's revealed that he's having this kind of repressed memories that we initially saw him trying to work through with Master Luke last season. Well, no, fuck me. It wasn't last season. It was in Book of Boba, right? Because I got a couple confused emailers like, how are we here? What? So, yeah.
Of course. They should have expected that.
But part of Luke, the Jedi training is kind of like, you know, dealing with all your shit. And Luke was helping him kind of uncover all these and process them. And here we get a really extended one, which is cool. So I just, introduce it.
And I like all the, you know, Forge as like metaphor. You know, not only do they work on their armor and their combat skills, but they hone themselves, right?
Yeah.
Both mentally and physically.
Yeah, I agree.
Good stuff. And then we get to Grogu's flashback. It's like you said, it is when the Order 66 stuff happened, and we're back at, I think, the Jedi Temple there in Coruscant. He's being hurried away by a bunch of Jedi as Imperial troops attack. He's put on a speeder bike by one of the Jedi, Kelleran, and they flee the troops. Though, then fly through, you know, traffic on Coruscant. They manage to lose the troopers. Grogu's taken off-world in a ship by Kelleran. And then we come back to the armor, and she forges Grogu a rondel with the Mando symbol on it.
Do you recognize the Jedi Master Kelleran?
I was going to make a lot of jokes in this scene about how Jar Jar Binks shows up and says, Misa got to get this baby out of here. I decided not to, because I think Ahmed Best is like, this might be his redemption tour.
Yes.
Like him trying to make you forget that he was Jar Jar Binks and how badly all that turned out. But
I looked into this, and it's pretty dark, and I thought it would be cool to talk about, because I the second time through, I found this extraordinarily moving. So this guy is Ahmad Best. He is best known as the voice actor and the
he's
the
Andy Serkis
guy
to Jar Jar.
Exactly.
Essentially.
Except for everyone hated Jar Jar, and nobody loved him.
Which is ridiculous, considering they're doing basically the same thing. Jar Jar is Gollum, but whatever.
But it's so that's what I'm saying. So Ahmed Best is this guy. He's only a couple years older than me. He was like born in 73. I was born in 76. So he grew up worshiping Star Wars, of course. Grew up in the Bronx. Had a flair for like theatrics. So he got into, various dance troupes and stuff. He was noticed while he was in Stomp. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. I remember it.
Yeah, like they're just banging pots and garbage cans and PVC pipes together, making music, and it's all very rhythmic. And this LucasArts representative saw Ahmad Best, with the garbage can strapped to his feet, stomping around, making the music. And they're like, oh, we need a physically gifted kind of actor who's got, a lot of strength and athleticism to portray this, like, combat frog that we're trying to get to, you know, because they're envisioned a lot of, like, battle scenes and all this other stuff. So they approached him and was like, hey, we want you to be in Star Wars. And Ahmad's like, this is super cool. I'm going to fucking be Chewbacca in the prequel series of Star Wars. Like, how jazzed he was about it. And he shows up on set, and they strap the frog head to him, and he's doing all the stuff. And I guess he had this decision when he was voicing his lines to, I read this interview where he's like, you know, I loved reading to my nieces and nephews. This kid's only like in his mid 20s at this point. And, you know, sometimes when I'd read him, I'd read in this exaggerated, what I call my kid voice, you know, that, oh, me, something this, me, something. And he started doing that on the set, and George Lucas liked it so much. He's like, oh, I want you to be his voice too. So now my best is like, you know, again, it's just something that he was doing. This is all just joyful, right? And the movie comes out and everybody hates it, and they heap a lot of fucking scorn on him. And we've seen this with Jake Lloyd. We've seen this with, what is it, Kelly Marie Tran. We've seen this with, who is the older Anakin? Christian Hayden. Like, people take their dislike and dissatisfaction for their thing, and instead of, like, blaming Lucas, blaming, you know, they focus the anger and hatred on the actor. Mm-hmm. This was so, and not only that, so that's bad enough that, like, you were Chewbacca, and everyone decided this Chewbacca sucks. But then, like, aside from the fan reaction, you had this other critical reaction of, like, not only is this just a bad character, but you've got this character who's, like, a stereotypical representation of certain segments of African American. As a black actor, that's got to be uniquely hurtful to be hear that, like, not only are you a shitty Chewbacca, but also you are embarrassing yourself and your whole race, and you're doing a step and fetch at sci-fi minstrel shit for the man's entertainment. And he's talked candidly that he became suicidal because of, like, this again, mid-20s is your big break. You think it's going to go the one way, and it completely goes the other. And he, like, wanted to kind of have nothing to do with Star Wars. So about 3 years ago, LucasArts, you know, approached him to be a Jedi, some kind of minor Jedi role in, like, a trivia video game. And that was all fraught because, like, right when he was going to do it, COVID hit and it got delayed. I think this is a really nice touch to put Ahmad Best in this badass Jedi Master who single-handedly saves Baby Yoda's ass against overwhelming odds. Like you said, the redemption tour, I think that's, I just think it's super cool. I got kind of, like, emotional when I was reading his statements about it and how much it meant to him. And, like, damn, I hope we can, as a fandom, and unfortunate prize, there's new fans born every day, but I hope we learn something about this that, like,
sure,
holy hell, let's not make these people's lives miserable when they do something we don't like, right? You know? Like,
yeah, you can hate the character, don't hate the actor.
The world would not be better if Ahmad Best had, like, offed himself or become a heroin addict because of how hundreds of thousands of people, how mean they were about this thing to him. So I don't know. I just thought it was really moving, and I got a real kick out of seeing this guy just kick so much ass. He was super cool.
Yeah, I wish it was a bigger part. I wish that it was something that could be an ongoing part. That, to me, would be the real redemption, because Jar Jar wasn't in one scene. Jar Jar wasn't in a flashback. Jar Jar has made much more of a mark on Star Wars than this Kelleran character. Yeah, I don't know what's happening in, like, some of the other series. Maybe they're going to have him as an ongoing character. If that's the case, good, because that's what it'll take. It's not going to be one scene, I think, that does it.
Well, if anyone survives cool the Jedi Purge, it would be this guy. And I think that because Ahmad's almost 50 now. Of course, you got the whole black don't crack thing. But they sure could. I think he looked plausibly in his early 30s. It would be very easy for him to come back, I think, with some gray, like, you know, gray in his beard and hair, and maybe a little less makeup and de-aging, and he could play. Because we know various Jedi Masters did survive the Purge, and this guy, when the lone survivors of Coruscant with the only... But yeah, I didn't even like the little touches, like, you know, that there's, like, this one loyalist Naboo guard that prepared a starship to get all the younglings away, and they could only get the one, and the without hesitation. I don't know. I get all choked up when people do crazy shit for kids. But, like, these guys just, like, in a snap decision, like, decide to lay down their lives and die so this guy can escape with his kid. I don't know. I thought it's pretty cool.
No, it is cool. I like the chase. I like pretty much everything about this scene.
They got to use the tallest mountain on Coruscant again. They crash land on that plaza.
Oh, did they? I missed that.
Yeah.
Is that when he's, like, skittering around on the ground there? Okay.
On the speeder bike, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, it's a pretty exciting scene. Good piece of action. Probably the best bit of action. I don't know.
It's good Jedi.
It's
good
toss Jedi. Up. You know, it's this or the dragon, but I like this
just
a lot.
Good Jedi v clone troopers. And then, you know, back in the present, Baby Yoda processing all this. I like, you know, the Mudhorn sigil returning, because this goes back to our pod. This is they are a tribe of two, you know. And like them reinforcing that, I thought was really cool. And she says you're going to grow in this Rondel. Not as much as you'd think.
Yeah.
You give him 900 years, he might add another 6 inches. Uh-huh. And a couple pounds, but like, nah, he's really not going to.
I mean, he's 50 years old. He's getting up there anyway.
Well, see, okay, there's the other question.
Uh-huh.
I went back and forth between the scene of him in hyperspace, because that's how it ends, and then him. I think they're suggesting that he is actually aging normally now that he's like out of stasis, because wasn't his whole deal is he was in stasis for a lot of time?
I think you're right, yeah.
So when he's 50, I think he's like, it's not that like it takes Yoda's species this much time to get to maturity. I noticed that his head is a little less smooth, a little hairier in the present day than it was in that flashback. It could be my imagination.
Right.
I'm curious at what other people think. Mando@baldmove.com. But like, I wonder if he is going to start aging. Because the other thing, I don't know, we mentioned this, Baby Yoda started to speak. Like when Bo-Katan and Mando told themselves this is the way in the previous episode, and they in the background, Grogu's going wah, 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 just making these kind of squeaky noises. If you pay attention, he is choking out. This is the way.
This is full. If baby's first words are the slogan of your cult, it's in trouble. The baby is in trouble.
Well, the other thing is, so what I saw that on YouTube, but I can't remember the line of dialogue, but like either in the Book of Boba or earlier this season, he said another phrase too, like a short phrase. But yeah, you think it'd be Dada or Pedro or Mando or something. But yeah, this is the way. That's how cults work, man.
Probably may the force be with you. Yeah, no, this baby's going to be all kinds of fucked up, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I remember there was this one couple in the Kingdom Hall that we went to that like bragged that their kid's first name was Jehovah.
Okay.
Rather than mom or, and I like, even back when I was fully mentally in, I like, that's kind of fucked up, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think
how do
so,
you understand, but you understand your heavenly father through your relationship with your earthly parents, right? Like that's what you're supposed to do. And
that, sure, that sounds right.
They're probably lying for clout. Lying for spiritual clout.
Yeah, that's what you do.
So right. three day demerit off eternal life in paradise, brother. You lie for spiritual clout. Anyway.
All right, let's move on to Bo and Mando's team landing near the dragon's lair. To avoid detection in the proceeding on foot, they detect the dragon atop a mesa and camp at its base for the night, where Bo learns how to eat as a Mandalorian. Apparently, they have this ritual where the leader of the war party gets to stay by the fire to eat, and everybody takes off their helmets, but the rest of them do it in private, far away from the fire. Which just makes me like so many questions, so very many questions about the logistics of this. Do they have a designated amount of time that they eat for, and you can't return to the fire in case you would see the war party's leader with their helmet off during that amount of time? Or do they just kind of like wander back and just nobody talks about it if they see the war party leader with their helmet off?
When Bo's done, she's supposed to stand up and like Yosemite Sam just fire her guns in the air and say yeehaw.
All right, that would work.
I did just remind me, I did think of like, how bad would it suck to live next to a covert of Mandalorians? We're like,
what,
the worst kind of redneck neighbor
eating?
Like they're like the armor's banging on steel all day, they're letting off weapons and grenades and shooting shit up, and their jetpacks are roaring in and out, and it's every fucking day. Like imagine 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, these are just outside your window, ting ting pow pow boom. It's like Jesus fucking Christ, these guys every day, they never stop. Like it would get old. I really felt for those people on the ring world. Because it's one thing if you're out in the desert and you're just, you know, you're in some kind of accursed wasteland world. But you're doing that shit in a major metropolitan area. It's just not cool, man. It's not cool.
Yeah, imagine if you're born onto Mandalore pre-destruction, and that's it, man. The whole planet's doing this Sunday at 6 a.m.
Yeah,
and you don't, and you're not into it. I mean, it's hell. It's hell. You can leave that planet as soon as you can find a way off.
This is the way. I don't know what to tell you. You're grunting and sweating and shooting every damn day of your life, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
This is the flaw of the episode. There's a curious lack of urgency on these Mandalorians for saving this child. Like, I couldn't fucking believe it when they're like, well, it's getting dark. We should camp here before we start climbing. What? Are these flying Sarlaccs? It takes 1,000. It just seemed like you would think this thing would feed its child. And I thought maybe it's like, oh, it's going to be like kind of some kind of spider thing where it stores its prey. And I thought that's where they're going at the heat source buried in the nest. But like, I would really like to understand this thing just rolls these Mandalorian youths in its mouth for 24 to 48 hours. And
I guess what, so.
It just like, again, a curious lack of urgency to actually recover this kid. But
yeah, it's not like they've really ever seen this procedure before, right? They don't know anything about the way this thing feeds its young because they've never found it before, so
they know that it's killed a lot of Mandalorians. We see a few pieces of Mandalorian armor and helmets in its nest. It's but whatever, we'll wait it out. I'm sure it'll be fine. Get up tomorrow morning. It's cool.
Well, they needed a scene where they made Bo feel important because she's the leader of the war party and she gets to take her helmet off at the fire.
It's just
it's what the show does.
Wish they could have figured out a different way to do that.
So the next day they plan their approach to the dragon. They're going to be as stealthy as possible, and they climb to the dragon's nest, but the dragon isn't around. They search for the boy, and instead they find some baby dragons, and the adult dragon returns, starts feeding the boy to her babies. So they attack. The dragon runs with Paz and the boy in tow, one in mouth, one in claw. The Mandos go after it. They free Paz and then the boy and drop the dragon into the water where it's eaten by a bigger fish. There's always a bigger
fish. Always a bigger fish. Always. Yeah. And then Paz and the Mandos say some pretty husky, this is the ways of each other. I feel like they're both pretty emotional in this moment.
How could you not be? He just saved his son.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the production design. It's essentially just a mega bald eagle nest. I laughed out loud every single time this dragon horks up this kid. Mm-hmm. It's just like a baby, just a mama robin, like this full grown, this youth comes out of its throat and is dangling and like.
I love it. What a terrible experience for the kid.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's been Sarlacc for 20. He's got to be terrified.
And he's just sitting there. He's in the stomach of this thing. He's sitting there thinking, God damn it, he hit me with all three darts at once. How could I be so stupid?
That's right. You disappointed your Mandalorian father, your stern, taciturn Mandalorian father. And as you're brooding about that, this giant dragon comes and just takes you and swallows you.
Yeah.
Fuck me. It's a bad day. That's a bad day.
Guess kid's name is Ragnar. I never knew that until this scene, so to my notes here.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if he's going to continue to be important. Oh, the other thing is I've kind of turned around how I feel about the Mandalorians and their colorful armor. At first I thought it wasn't cool, but like now that I've seen him fight a couple times, they're not like a military unit so much as they are like a whole bunch of gladiators that are just fighting together.
Yeah,
you know, they don't really do teamwork. They're all kind of independent. They're more like knights of old. You know, they get called up to do, and like it reminds me of like those the knights chivalric heraldry. Like they were guard. You know, it wasn't like in the movie Excalibur, wherever all these knights are wearing these identical gleaming armor and every they look all they did have just like this motley collection of colors and flags and banners and cloaks and whatnot. And I think you're supposed to understand. These guys are a lot more like that. They have this chivalric code, and I think I've changed my mind. I think it's cool now.
All right.
And it's not too garish. It's not too Power Ranger-y. It is very muted, There's a lot of interesting color combinations, but I do like it that they're
yeah.
very individual warriors that are coming together for common causes rather than like an elite unit like the clone troopers.
It would almost be worse if they were wearing matching armor. I mean, just individually, like all their armor matched.
Yeah.
Because then you would have like a pink ranger or a red ranger situation, you know, it'd be weird. I like that it's kind of this hodgepodge of like, oh, you got a green pauldron and a blue helmet and whatever else. Yeah.
And it makes sense because we know that like these things are awarded individually by merit. So you probably get them at different times. You might get them, you know, it might be hand-me-down from other warriors who've died. And it looks mm-hmm. like that. It looks like something that's collected piece. It's weird that the Mandalorian is like kind of like this gleaming chrome. Like, is that weird in Mandalorian culture? Like, you're not even going to paint your armor, dude. Like, you had enough Beskar yeah. to make a whole fucking suit of armor and you're just going to leave it unpainted? What the hell? But it doesn't seem like it that.
Is so all of their armor isn't Beskar, right? Like,
I think so. It's all about Beskar.
It's all Beskar?
I think so.
Then what was Mando wearing before this?
He's like, so like, I think you start off with a helmet because the Paz's kid just has the jumpsuit and helmet. And the Mandalorian was like earning his other bits of gear.
So he threw away his old helmet when he got the Beskar one? Like,
well, I'm assuming he donated to the Foundling Reserve Fund or whatever.
Hmm. See, I was under the impression that this wasn't all Beskar and that these pieces were like, maybe you can't dye Beskar the same way or whatever because it's a different type of metal.
So they got like some Mandalorians who are poor or inexperienced have like Durasteel armor or Plasteel armor. Or...
That was my headcanon, but I couldn't tell you exactly why.
Huh.
I could be wrong about that. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's probably more important that he show off his Beskar if that's the case. Then
I
like,
do think
the
Mando is the coolest looking one because he is got that yeah. like gleaming chrome. I think that's a fucking super cool look, but I do think it's weird that every other Mando, even like Bo-Katan has like, you know, her shit's all, you know, painted stuff. She gets a new piece from the armor and it's unpainted, but presumably she's going to repaint that. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the other thing. The more we see them armor go to work, we saw her do this a couple episodes ago, but like this isn't just like a plate of armor. There's like intricate circuitry and like technology. Yeah. I wonder, you know, we've made fun of like when the Mandalorian goes running down a hallway drawing fire and like the stormtroopers are shooting, like, man, it's a good thing they're just hitting him in the chest plate and the knee pads. I wonder if you're supposed to understand that these armor also project a field that's similar to like a like some kind of like force field that's similar to like a chainmail, you know, that you would wear under your armor. So like these big obvious gaps of armor are actually not, you know, it's protected. You have additional protection. It's not as strong as the armor itself, but because else what the fuck is this? I could have sensors and all that other stuff too, but like when she did it, the Baby Yoda's rondelle, I'm like, well, there's got to be something more to this because what the hell else is this thing doing? Baby Yoda doesn't even have a helmet to integrate sensors into, so
yeah,
betting is some kind of passive force field.
Could be. I wonder if we'll see that like activated for Baby Yoda, for Grogu.
Yeah.
Before he gets the rest of his armor. Can it activate before you get the rest of your armor? I don't even know.
Anyway, just a little headcanon for myself.
Yeah. So the team returns to the Mando covert and Bo-Katan is congratulated by the armor. They reveal that they've brought the baby dragons back to be trained. Yikes. I don't know where they're going to get a helmet the size of these baby dragons, but...
Oh, can I mention another possibility?
Sure.
So you and I, for One Bald Move Christmas, we watched the infamous Star Wars Holiday Special.
Yes.
The best part of that, it's really not even that great, is the Boba Fett cartoon that happens like in the back third of it. There's like the standalone, like 9-minute episode. It's well animated, but Boba Fett rides into battle this like Loch Ness monster looking creature. I wonder if they're trying to backdoor honor that piece of canon by suggesting that the Mandalorians also, like, whenever they slay a giant beast that leaves, like, they raise that vicious beast up to be, I mean, I don't think these things could be full Mandalorians. They're not sentient creatures, but, you know, I think it'd be really cool, the idea of, like, the screaming, the Canyon Hawk or whatever, if that strike team is going to be riding dragons in the future because of this episode.
Yeah. No, I imagine that's probably where they're going. These can be their mounts.
Because otherwise, like, we've never seen a Mandalorian before or after ride some vast dinosaur beast into battle, but I hope they do that. It'd be cool.
You got Boba Fett riding a Rancor. That's pretty cool.
Right. This is a thing that at least Boba Fett does. And Mandalore himself is famous for taming and riding a Mythosaur. So, like, yeah, get back to your beast-riding roots. This is the way.
I'm in. That's cool. Mando's on dragons. Why not? Finally, seeing that Bo has lost a pauldron, the armor forges her a new one. Bo requests that it have the Mythosaur on it. Mythosaur? That's what it is. Bo tells the armor that she saw a real Mythosaur on Mandalore, and the armor... I think she's just commending her for her faith here. I don't think she actually believes that she saw a true Mythosaur, but she loves that she believes it, right? The armor loves that Bo believes it, because it shows how devoted she is.
The armor is super enigmatic, like all these fucking mask-wearing people are, but I got it where I think the armor is pleased either way. Like, either it flatters her worldview that the second you start taking our creed seriously, you either get a faith, you get visited by the Mythosaur in your dreams as a measure of faith, you know, or if you actually saw, that's even better. Like, I don't think the armor, you know, like, would think that sucked. I think she'd think that's cool. It might be a little bit like, you know, well, keep walking and see what happens. But, like, I gotta be, I don't know. This is, or that to the Mandalorians, their faith is so strong that it should seem real. You know, when she says, but it was real, this is the way.
If you believe that your vision was real, that's a good thing, right? You're fully bought in. So, yeah.
But this is an intentional, this is like Bo-Katan, and I don't even know if I'm going to say this is a sin. This is her wrapping herself up in the flag of the Mandalore people.
Yeah,
the Mandalorian
totally.
People.
I don't know if it is cynical or if it's legit. I'm coming down the side of, she's having an actual conversion here. I know it's happening, but, like, it's happening really fast, but I think it's genuine.
I think what I hope happens is that she sees the good of this cult, you know, and the fact that they help each other. They, instead of tearing each other down and warring with each other, they, you know, take a portion of their proceeds and they make sure they take care of the young ones and their families, and it's all very collective. And it's like there's no hesitation. Like, if one of them gets attacked, they all join. Like, she's comparing that to her experience of these fractious, fickle, you know, highborn Mandalorians, that
the ones that left her because she didn't have the Darksaber. Right.
And I think she's seen the strength of this, that there's some kind of, like, commonality and belief and purpose and unity that she admires here. But, like, I hope they find a way to, like, take some of the freedom that they enjoy as enlightened Mandalorians and, like, return to the roots in terms of solidarity and fraternity and egalitarian equality and all that, the other stuff. But I don't know. I think I'd be super disappointed if Bo-Katan just joins the cult long term, you know, and becomes as rigid and unyielding as the rest of them.
Yeah. I don't know. I am curious to see how it goes, how she synthesizes her feelings from before with what she's learning about this particular covert here. Because who's to say all the coverts are like this, you know?
Well, true. And how many of them are? Yeah, like, is this like a dying cult, you know? Is there only one? I don't know, because it seems like there's just so many Mandalorians in this one. I would, like, at least 100?
Maybe? I mean, I would say
way more than we've ever seen
at
before.
At least, like, 50 at the very low side. But, yeah, potentially a lot more.
I have another meta question for you.
Oh boy.
You think Katie's wearing the armor?
No.
Or is she taking a little acting vacation like Pedro? Because if you don't know background in this story, is like I've read in many interviews that like Pedro does not wear the armor.
No,
he
why would
has
you?
Been in it for a handful of scenes. Obviously, the times when he's had to take his helmet off and whatnot. But most of the time, his involvement is reading the scripts, going into the booth, recording his dialogue, and that is. Do you think Kate like as soon as she saw his scripts, like, so I'm going to be wearing my helmet for everything but 5 minutes this season. I want the Pedro deal.
Uh-huh. And they were like, well, the Pedro deal is you get paid scale. So, and she was probably like, fine, I can also film something else while I'm doing this. Yeah, no, I don't know why you would ever care to act in the suit. Like,
because you were an actor and you liked the chat. Like, was an interview where Katie said that she really liked the challenge of acting with just her body language. So, like, that implies that maybe she is, but...
So maybe this season she will, and maybe next season
she'll renegotiate for the Pedro deal. Or maybe I do think that they are trying to work to... That's why I keep on thinking there's a synthesis here, is that it does seem like long-term you want to get Pedro, but also Pedro's never been hotter. You know, unless they locked him down in season one to, like, a post-season four helmet reveal clause, they might be a victim of the just Pedro's success because he is just so fucking hot right now.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes on TV shows, they do lock you down for multiple seasons. But, you know, season three, we're starting to look like maybe you could be at the end of a contract like that. Three years is a pretty long time. Three seasons, rather. It's a pretty long time.
Yeah, I do wonder what they have long term. Is it going to be like once they... Because that's the thing is like... If you finish a story of The Mandalorian, you'd still maybe have Din Djarin and Grogu, and they could be part of the larger Star Wars universe and have movies and be in the, you know, Ahsoka's story. And, like, you don't need to continue to have seasons, but, you know, get them for an episode or two commitment. I don't know. I hope she's wearing armor. I was kind of a little bummed that I found out that Pedro wasn't.
Yeah, I don't think the show requires it. Like, they're not doing complex enough acting for them to need to feel like they're, you know.
How dare you?
Emoting through the armor. They can literally get in a booth and just record this dialogue in 2 minutes. It's not complex. It's not, you know, difficult for an actor to deliver these lines, especially the way they're acting. They're coaching him or directing him to act. It's not... Mm-hmm. This isn't going to win any awards, is what I'm saying, other than the technical stuff. So, yeah, just get in the booth for 2 minutes and go film stuff like The Last of Us, where you can actually show off your chops.
Do not remove your helmet. We'll be right back. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
This is the way. Back to the podcast, because here's more Tribe of Two. All right, we do have some feedback. We weren't able to do this last week because we ran out of time, but we do have some time on the shorter episode to catch up. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
Mando at baldmove.com. First up is Tim. They say in season one, they make the best car seem like it's so valuable that an ingot is worth risking your life on a top tier bounty. Now we find out an irritable spider hobo is hoarding it all. Now that he's dead or just more pissed off, but gone at least, all Mando needs to do is scoop up a few helmets slash cod pieces and he and Grogu can build a new Razor Crest out of the stuff if they want. Nothing else, they could bring it back to the hammering lady and tell her to go swim in it. Beskar problem solved.
Oh man, a Beskar ship. A
that
Beskar ship for
sweet.
Mando.
Jesus.
Are they hinting at that with the unpainted N1?
Ooh.
Could you just replace panels in the N1 with the Beskar?
Could be. I've often wondered if the N1 was going to be a transition starship because it's useless for bounty hunting. It really is.
Uh-huh.
Especially if you can't use the rear pod for, you know, Grogu purposes. Or, I mean, yeah, if you have to use it for Grogu purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, Tim, I don't think this is a plot hole. I think this is a evolution of world building that, like, Beskar was scarce because the Empire bombed it. And there is this, like, myth of Mandalore being destroyed and toxic and haunted and cursed. So they couldn't just go back to the surface. It wasn't just the spider that's guarding it. It's the fact that, you know, their world got devastated and then the Mandalorians seemed to descend into some kind of like low level civil war, amongst themselves. So I do think that, yeah, what they're doing is telling story is like a Mandalorian resurgence, potentially, that they're going to come back like the Jedi did.
Yeah. It's strange to me that no Mandalorian has ever gone back to Mandalore to see what could be salvaged there. But yeah. Yeah, I think that when the mine shut down and Beskar has become precious.
It could also be that the mines were nearly exhausted, so there still isn't, like, there might be bits and scraps of metal and armor here and there, but like, because maybe that's what the spider's doing. He's harvesting these like leftover scraps of metal, but like there's not like enough for like wide scale. But I don't know. They've never really said that in lore, and you think Bo-Katan would know that as the the Mandalorian king's daughter. The other thing I wondered if there's like an iron price situation like we had in with the Greyjoys, the Iron Islanders, and the Game of Thrones, where it's like Beskar to scavenge is not like you maybe you can contribute it to the youngling pool, but like it seems dishonorable. You have to win something in combat or by completing a mission. You have to earn it. You can't just like go and dig it up out of the ground.
Sure, like the Darksaber.
Yeah, I wonder if they're hinting at that. But anyway, Christine says Disney Plus now has a section where it has the top 10 episodes of Clone Wars and Rebels
that specifically has the episodes that pertain to The Mandalorian. So Disney's doing a smart thing, which is they've got all this universe-spanning content. They're starting to curate individual episodes and arcs that they think you need to get the background of the stuff and appreciate it. I also didn't watch all the cartoons. My husband did, so he'd normally just fill in all the gaps for me. But after this last week's episode, I saw that little section in Disney Plus and decided to check it out. And I'm glad I did. Gave me so much more color and context. There's actually some super cool stuff with Garth Maul, killing Bo-Katan's sister with the Darksaber in front of Obi-Wan, and it was just cool to see what the planet looked like before it was destroyed. As someone who is like, do I need to watch all that? I can say that it was worth it. Though, thought it might help since you guys don't seem to know much about the background and your breakdowns. No offense, sometimes you guys make me laugh when you're just guessing about things. One last thing, the Mandalore is a title specifically for the ruler of Mandalore. So the people on the whole are called Mandalorians, not Mandalore, even though the planet itself is called Mandalore. Well, that fucking makes a lot of sense. At this point, 3 seasons in, I think part of the charm of our podcast is that we haven't watched the cartoons and we are a bunch of Gen X, older millennial dads and uncles that are just like, we hate the prequels, we hate the sequels, we're thoroughly disenchanted with most modern Star Wars, we like the Mando and we like the Ando, and everything else can go Bando itself, right? At this point I'm like, I don't care if Mickey Mouse comes with a Beskar briefcase handcuffed to his wrist with only the seconds of animation that I need with the core dialogue. I don't care. I like discovering it through everyone's feedback. And I like ignoring the shit that seems stupid to me. I like that.
Yeah.
And apparently thousands of other people do too, because I kind of wondered in season 3 if like, is anyone to come back to, because we just like shit on Boba Fett so much, but here people mm-hmm. are. So mm-hmm. maybe to listen to despite, but despite turns to like, that turns to love, then obsession, and then it goes to what? I don't know. It's a pretty, hatred, you'll probably want to stop from obsession. Yeah.
Yeah.
Restraining orders branches out into that after a while.
I was going to say pain and suffering, but yeah.
I like to get the restraining order in place before the pain and suffering starts.
Fair.
No offense to Yoda.
The restraining bolts. I am a big fan of the idea, if you want me to know something, put it on screen in the show I'm watching. Don't rely on me to have seen something else. And on the Marvel side, they do this pretty well. I just watched Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania. Felt like I knew basically everything I needed to know for that, and I have not seen either of the other Ant-Man movies. Here in Star Wars, I think they have colossally flopped on that with the Book of Boba Fett Mando stuff. And then, you know, Clone Wars and all that stuff that ties in. I just don't think I should be required to go watch a different show to understand the show I'm watching. And I don't think it's impossible to like understand, you know, the Bo-Katans of the Mando without all that stuff.
I'm not saying
you don't have a rich background and context for all this, but you don't really need it. Whereas the Book of Boba Fett stuff is absolutely crucial to the story here. You have to go watch that other show. Otherwise, you're not going to know what's happening here.
Yeah. And it so sucks because honestly, with 30 seconds more of previously on, I don't even think that's true. Like, if they just show previously on
is the crazy thing. Like, you can't just make up scenes and previously on,
in a completely other fucking show about a fucking other character.
Previously on is supposed to remind you of the things that have happened in the show you're watching in case you forgot, not be all brand new to you if you've not seen any of it.
See, that's why I think they need to take a cue from the Marvel side and treat this more like these aren't individual series, but these are like a whole canon universe. And, you know, they really need, like, I think they should just do the comic style footnotes occasionally. Like, you know, there should just be something on the thing that flies across as like, see Book of Boba Fett, Return of Mandalorian for more, you know. see WandaVision episode 3, season 3, episode 7 for more. Like, they just, yeah, it works really well in comic books, and there's precedent on the Marvel side. And just do, fuck, Star Wars had comic books too. They did the same thing. Just do a little subtitle that says, for more information, see this.
Well, obviously, if it bothered me to not be as informed as I could be here on the podcast, I would have watched them by now. So yeah. Apparently it doesn't.
Yeah. And I know, but the other thing is, like, if it's like the people that really bothers, like, would probably be insufferable on the podcast. And there's tons of, the other thing is, like, we don't get screeners for this. Like, a lot of the people that do the exhaustive breakdown, here's a dirty little secret for a lot of your favorite, I'm gonna attack anybody, but I do know a lot of people that suggest that they are experts at this shit. Mm-hmm. Literally are watching screeners and desperately doing internet searches because no one fucking knows all this stuff, you know.
Sure.
So, like, I don't, yeah, I think a lot, but that's, it's fine. And the thing is, we can't compete with that because we don't get screeners for Disney Plus stuff, and we're always going to be at least 2 days after, if not more. And rather than do a shitty job of exploring these things I don't really care about, mm-hmm. I'm content mm-hmm. to let some of the larger, more equipped, more professional outfits do it. And we're just going to shitpost about Star Wars. So, mm-hmm. that in mind, let's go to Virgilio, who says, you guys went in depth on a bit of the AI implications of programming self-preservation in droids, especially as regards to R5-D4. My own headcanon, I've come up with the following. A droid just needs enough motivation, i.e. self-preservation, for their AI to be obedient to humanoids, lest they face the consequences of not following orders, memory wipes, destruction, etc. But it must be a delicate balance that they can easily get out of whack. A droid motivated too much by self-preservation is paralyzed by its fear, its own demise. With too little motivation, won't care if they live or die. While we see R5 clearly on the too much motivation side in this episode, I think it now explains why he's essentially melted down spontaneously in A New Hope. The bad motivator, R5's AIs, were unable to see any point in existing and blew up.
Damn, the motivator thing, surprisingly unliterally, I don't know.
Yeah, I always thought because I think he's thinking motivator of like an actor being like, what's my motivation, and a director. Yeah. I'm thinking motivator literally like the Star Wars phrase for engine.
Right. It's the motor. You know? It's the thing that actually turns the wheels of the robot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Hadn't considered it. But there must be some kind of thing, some device, some part in there that gives them personality, and motivation would be part of that.
It is something that I'm surprised there's not more commentary on, that droids in Star Wars seem to be sentient creatures, but it's up to the individual human or alien of how much dignity you give their person. Like, some people, Luke Skywalker seems to give them more than others. You got people like Han Solo and Leia, they're kind of somewhere in the middle, and then you've got the, like, no droids allowed here kind of, you know, Jabba torturing him, making him fight in gladiator pits, and it's, like, all over the place. And, like, unlike many other fictional things where I've seen tons of ink being spilt about, like, how we feel about house elves and Harry Potter and things like that, it's very little remarked upon about how, like, fucked it is. Again, you don't have to give these people complex emotions and feelings to if you just want a race of beings completely, don't give them any of that quirky shit. But
yeah,
you do, and you just
follow commands, and that's it.
Yeah, and you put restraining bolts on them and mind wipe them to keep them in compliant and torture them in some cases. Like, it's it's a lot. Drew says, I'm looking forward to your Mando coverage more than any other reviewers. See, our methods yielded in results here. Your experience with the Jehovah's Witnesses makes me curious of how you see things. Many people have been very moved by Mando reuniting with his clan, but for me, the shunning and subsequent love bombing feels so sinister. Do you think the showrunners believe all this is sinister, or am I bringing in my own biases?
I don't think they do. I think if I had to guess how Mando is going to go, is that they view the Mandalorian cult as this universally positive thing. It's the culture of a race of beings here. Mm-hmm. And it's one of like honor and one of togetherness and unity and love. And like they're endowing it with so many positive qualities. And I don't see them talking enough about the negative qualities, the shunning, the
rigid control of thought and expression.
All the negatives that you think of when you think of the word cult. I don't think they're thinking of this group as a cult. They're thinking of them as a religion. And
yeah.
I don't see much of a distinction between the two, frankly.
And it's sometimes like you, like when you're within a community, you don't see like how fucked up things are. Like and it doesn't even have to be religious cults. Like I was watching this interview with this one MMA guy, and he was talking about his dad and this one experience he had where his mom and his dad got divorced. I'll let you imagine why. And like years later, she is with this other guy who then starts an affair with the neighbor lady literally across the street. And the dad, the ex-husband, the current father comes home and finds out that this person's disrespecting his ex-wife. And he goes across the street and he just beats the shit out of him. And like, you know, the ex-wife is like, oh, my God, Frank, stop, stop, stop. And then after he comes over, he tells a story, and he's got some times like his dad's coming over with bloody knuckles, and he grabs his son, who was 12 at the time, and grabs him and says, I just did your job for you. You're the man of the house now. You should be doing this kind of shit. And he's telling this with like tears in his eye and like, I can't believe how great of a man my father was. And I'm like, this is a tale of harrowing abuse on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. But you've got it all twisted, and so like I think, you know, I have enough faith in the double F's that they surely have to know that there is some crazy shit, and that there's got to be, just like there's balance in the force between the Jedi who were too rigid and unemotional and devoid of not just attachments to things, but like attachments to each other, and the Sith, who are cruel and selfish and you know, power hungry, there's a balance between that. There's like both sides are crazy. Surely he sees that there's a balance between the people that don't respect community and culture and the solidarity and stuff of the Mandalorian cult has versus the Mandalorian cult itself, which is this rigid hierarchical that demands total obedience and a total conformity of thought. Surely they understand that.
Maybe. I hope so, because what I see happening right now is I see this singularity that is the Mandalorians gathering up all the goodwill in this show. You know, Mando himself, the hero of the story, the protagonist, is going to great lengths to become part of the cult again. Because he believes this is the way. This is the way is the slogan that everyone uses to say, like, I mean, even amongst the fandom, right? I think, like, this is a blind spot for the fandom as well. Everybody walks around repeating this is the way, as if this is some honorable good thing to do, to brainwash yourself with slogans of cults. The bad guys are very clearly bad guys in this show. The cult is winning people over. I see all the goodwill gathering and being sucked up into the Mandalorians here. I don't know if maybe they're like preparing for a big surprise, like where, oh, all along we've been tricking you into thinking the Mandalorians are the best. Turns out they're not the best. They're flawed like anybody else, right? And maybe even worse so. I don't know if that's coming, but if it's not, which I suspect it's not, then yeah, they're not really taking the cult stuff seriously.
What's really funny is when we were talking about it, you mentioned This Is the Way, is like, I forgot there is a song in the JW hymn book called This Is the Way.
Oh Jesus, yeah.
And it uses that phrase like 16 times to reinforce the different tenets of the witness. Like, oh damn, why? Yeah, sometimes like it's been so long that I forget, like, Jesus, we're in a no shit cult, dude.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, Matt from Canada says, to answer one of your questions, the Night Owls are a Filoni creation from the Clone Wars. It's not something that's introduced here. It's the name of the unit Bo-Katan led before the Purge of Mandalore. If she has any personal allies remaining, they would still presumably be Night Owls. I also love that they spell it N-I-T-E.
All right.
Like the old Watchman hero.
Sure.
or a person that stays up too late. These, you know. To speculate on the dehumanizing numbers used for the former Imperials. Ah, yes. My thought was this allows the amnesty seekers to fully break with their tainted identities. Dr. Pershing goes into program. Scientist L-52 is rehabilitated. When this is deemed complete, they give him a new identity, clear of any association with his past, other than perhaps sealed records of all this that the Republic keeps in case of recidivism, and send him on his way. Not sure it's supported by anything in the text of the show, but it's a logical reason to do it if it's not just them taking revenge on Imperials. Yeah.
Let him give this speech as Dr. Pershing?
I thought so too. That seems to be at odds with this theory, but yeah. I think it still makes the New Republic seem sinister, because I just like anytime you strip away a person's name and give them a number, like that has never been seen as like a positive thing.
No, it's dehumanizing, right?
Right.
And usually it's intended to be so.
Kind of like a brainwashing thing too, you know, to be. I mean, it can be positive. Like I'm not saying like you convert to certain religions, you might get a new name. You know, if you attain achievement in a particular society, you might get names and titles and stuff, and that's different than someone taking your name away and giving and imposing it on you, right? So I don't know. I thought it's intended to show that the New Republic is a little fucked up. Like that's what I got from that episode. That there are elements in the New Republic that are kind of sick. Ross says I just would like to offer a contrarian opinion on why the Mind Wipe machine might have a power dial. There are many species in the universe that form part of the New Republic, so an argument could be made that based on a species' anatomy, a human may need only a 1 to function therapeutically, but a Mon Calamari might need to jack the machine up to 10 to meet their needs. I'm probably just providing plot cover for a show that hasn't earned it, especially since the current turned red, which seemed to indicate that, yeah, this is bad.
Know that it's got a human and it's in
right,
its
it calibrates
and,
it.
Say, yeah.
I do like that because they even mentioned that like some minds are stronger than others in terms of some species. Who the fuck was the Watto? Their species.
I don't remember the flying slave driver
in Tatooine. He mentioned that his species, the mind tricks don't work on them. Now, I don't know if that was just his bravado. It seemed not to work, or it seemed to not work though. That makes a lot of sense. I didn't even think in terms of like, yeah, you might need to crank it up to get through to Ithorian or.
Yeah, makes sense.
They're just heads are different size. You got to get to penetrate to the therapeutic level. Erin says, I just watched episode 3 last night and didn't really enjoy it. I wasn't sure why. After listening to your podcast, I think my main issue is with Dr. Pershing's stuff. It felt completely disjointed for what's happening with Din Djarin, and while I agreed that everything with the Doctor was compelling, I felt like a completely different show. It left me with so many questions about the comms officer that I don't really care what happens to Jin and the group next. I just want to stay on Coruscant. Maybe that feeling is what the writers want, but it feels wrong that in a show called the Mandalorian stuff is honestly the least interesting part of it now. I feel like the showrunners are writing themselves in a corner, but only time will tell. This is just a Disney plusification more than anything.
Yeah, this is their MO. They're going to cram 4 different shows into one show. Sometimes it's just parts of other shows that they've already got going, and they're going to cram them into this other show because it fits in the schedule and they feel like it.
They had all this pre-production done on Cara Dune, New Republic Ranger, and that muscle woman kind of went off the deep end in popular political thought. So they're like, fuck, we need another muscle woman to make into a New Republic Ranger. Ah, Katie O'Brien, here you go. And we're just going to jumpstart it. I honestly feel that's exactly what's happening. They are wanting to do something big with Katie O'Brien. They probably do have a lot of like plans around the New Republic, you know, because they built all those on ramps into these marshals and the New Republic police force that's like overmatched in the Outer Rim, and you need something like the Fenris Rangers in Star Trek. You know, they're trying to get something like that off the ground, and then they lost their star. So do you just give up or do you find another star? And just like the Book of Boba, like, that's a thin show, and then you take 2.5 episodes or a stealth Mandalorian season.
I agree with you. I think it sucks. I think it's stupid. It's incredibly stupid, but they're doing it. They're doing it over and over. Yeah, it's another example of just them shoehorning an entirely different show into the one you're watching so they can spin off something else. They can have another property for you to watch and get you more invested in the platform, you know?
And it's not, I'm not even going to say it's totally disconnected, because this guy served with Gideon. That clearly they're going to do something with Gideon, I imagine. But they killed this guy. So now you got this communication. Yeah, it, like I said, I imagine it will go somewhere that does connect loosely eventually. But it is a flaw with these Disney Plus things that they kind of expect you to watch all of them. And because of that, they don't expect you to go like, oh, fuck, or go on. They expect you to get excited that like, oh, where's this going to go? And I'm going to go on to my favorite Star Wars forum. I'm going to speculate about what we, oh, and this person was actually introduced in this comic book. And oh, they actually have a 4-arc thing. So now Felonious. Dave Felonious. Darth Felonious has taking the time to make a decade of fucking cartoons, and he's going to shove it down me and Jim's throat whether we like it or not in the fullness of time.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like they're trying to do the Marvelification of Star Wars, right? And I don't mean that from like the movies and TV shows. What I mean is the comics. Like they're trying to turn Star Wars into those comics that are weirdly interconnected, and they want you to read them all, right? The more issues they can get you to buy, the more shows they can get you to watch.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, like
plus for them.
Or at least, like, you know, when I was a kid and I was reading Spider-Man, I never was like, oh, the Punisher's here. This sucks. I hate this. It's like always cool to see your hero bounce off a new guy, or like, oh, I guess Spidey's technically a West Coast Avenger. Here comes the Thor to hang out for an episode. It wasn't like,
but they were hanging out with Spider-Man or whatever, right? They weren't like taking over, and it was a totally different story.
That's the thing. It wasn't like you're never going to see 5 episodes of like in the Amazing Spider-Man, the Mighty Thor just taking over,
right? Yeah. And them still calling it the Amazing Spider-Man. Where the fuck's my Spider-Man? Yeah.
Or worse yet, you've never heard of the Mighty Thor because he's a brand new comic character that might have been in a video game that was loosely based on a Marvel. Now it's like, oh boy, here's a 4 episodes Mighty Thor arc. Yeah.
It's so cynical. It's so cynical. I hate it. It's just
the thing,
for money.
I thought if there was like a creative vision where it's like, we want to build this massive interconnected universe and it's going to be awesome for blah, blah, blah. But it's so clearly just like, we have to hit these, you know, we paid $2 billion for this IP 10 years ago, and we've already made 10 times that money. But like, have you thought about the fact that we could be making more?
Right. And we've got a new streaming platform that we're trying to justify the existence of. We're trying to keep and get new subscribers for. Our stock price is going down because we haven't been able to do that very effectively. How do we do that? Well, we interconnect all of Star Wars. We force everybody to watch these 15 new shows that we've got.
Yeah. And it's get to the point now that like Marvel is losing their shit because a couple of their, like one or two of their Phase 4 or Phase 5 things didn't make like $1 billion worldwide. And there's like, you right. know, executives are being fired and shit over it. It's a lot. Yeah.
Well, Disney needs to buy their next property that's untainted and go all in on that. And they'll have another couple 5 years run of shitting up that property, and they can dump it into the vault, like, and bring it back in 20 years, and all this will cyclically reappear.
Do you feel me on this? Because like, I can feel the Star Wars love returning to my body. Like Andor, and then I think this has been a pretty good season of, man, like my expectations properly adjusted. I think this has exceeded my expectations in terms of like it's slightly more adult storytelling than I was expecting. And the one diversion I thought was fucking awesome. I really love to see more Coruscant. I like to see like the darker side of the New Republic. These kind of shades of gray is exactly what I was expecting out of a bounty hunter show. Between this and Andor's last season, I'm kind of like, again, I'm still got my guard up, and I honestly don't know where they're going in terms of like the movies, man. Like Did you see this week that they just announced that
Lindelof's not doing his
Lindelof bailed project? Yeah. Yeah. That's insane. I don't know what it sucks
because I know what a huge fan he is. Look, a lot of the people who've directed movies have been huge fans of Star Wars. Some of them have done it well. Some of them have done it very poorly. So I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but Lindelof is like, his batting average is so freaking high for me. I would have loved to see what he did with Star Wars. It's kind of a shame.
Yeah. I will see, because like I said, I've got faith, and I think they finally, with the double Fs, they've got some good hands for like long-term planning of the franchise. Like there's some firm hands on the wheel, but they just need to keep doing stuff like Andor and Mandalorian. It's too bad that they kind of like fucked up the Skywalker saga for everybody, but that's honestly been fucked since Return of the Jedi. So
I mean, I kind of take or leave Mando, especially with the stunts that they pull, putting half the season into a different show. But Andor to me is like, if there's going to be a thing that's going to bring my love for Star Wars back, it's that very adult focused content. It speaks to me like I'm the 40-year-old that I am, who's been in love with Star Wars his entire childhood and early 20s. And now I've grown up, you know? And I want to hear these stories. I don't want it to be baby Grogu's and shit like that all the time.
I think that's the one brilliant thing. Well, there's a lot of brilliant things that J.K. Rowling did with Harry Potter. And say what you will about J.K. today, and I could say a lot, but I think it's so brilliant to write a series that ages with its intended audience. Like, you join Harry Potter when he's a little child. He's like 10 or 11. And by the time, you know, he goes to a 7-year boarding school and he's like 17, 18 years old and having age-appropriate romances and the danger kind of scales and the things getting more dark and operatic. And that's just such a brilliant idea. And it's like, man, there was a chance in Star Wars to like keep that going, where like you are telling stories for the people who are now in their 40s and 50s. And yes, they loved that as a kid, but now they're wanting to grow. And I know I don't know how I feel about a rated R Star Wars, but certainly more adult storytelling along the lines of what they're doing in Andor would be appreciated by me. And I know maybe you need to have like different levels of, you know, like this is Star Wars mature or Star Wars teen or Star Wars kid. But like, I would really prefer them to do something like that rather than just, well, Star Wars has always been for children, so we're just going to pitch it at that level, because that means Star Wars is not for me as an adult. You know, like
that means people age out of it. And if they everyone on the planet to appreciate this stuff, they need all ages content.
You can keep it going with kids. Like, you know, when I had my son and he was really into Star Wars, like that was a really emotional thing that we're both into that together and it connected us. But like, my son's 16 now and he's grown out of The Mandalorian. He doesn't watch it with me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's moved on to The Expanse and Dune.
Yeah.
And For All Mankind. And The Mandalorian is just like, it's cool for like 5 minutes at a time, but like he'd rather go fucking play Tarkov with his buddies. So
of course
I do wish that they had like, you know, a franchise that scales with the viewer's experience, because we always got the kid shit. It's not like anyone's taking that away, but we have vanishingly few mature pieces of storytelling in Star Wars. That is our mailbag for this week. Thanks to everybody that sent in over the weeks. mando@baldmove.com when we get another chance to open it up. Yeah, that's going to do it for this week. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove, if you want to keep up with everything we're doing. If you like all of our science fiction, fantasy type coverage, I really encourage you to go ahead and find Bald Move Pulp, which is our feed that houses all this content, including The Mandalorian. If you're one of those people that have like 17 Bald Move subscriptions in their podcast app, get rid of that. Go find Bald Move Pulp and Bald Move Prestige, subscribe to that, and then you can get everything. And finally, if you're enjoying our content and you want to get more of it with no ads, I highly encourage you to join our club, support.baldmove.com, to get ad-free feeds and a ton of other bonus video and audio content. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week for more Mando. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
This is The Way.